Thank you, Tom. It's a great pleasure to be here sharing with you this morning. I've chosen to handle these two chapters that were assigned to me by talking about them in a roundabout way. The title of the presentation that I'm going to give today is called Prayer and Identity. Parker Palmer, a Quaker author, speaker, and visionary, is quite famous for his saying that the soul is shy. So if I appear somewhat shy this morning during this presentation, it is because I want to share a soul story with you. Actually, I'm going to share a part of my own soul journey as it relates to this book we are reading and the particular chapters of the book that were assigned to me. In sharing this story, I hope it will have some resonance with some or maybe all of you as you journey on into the Spirit in your own lives. I entered the convent when I was 20 years old. As part of a training for becoming a religious woman, I was taught a practice of prayer that continues for me even today. In those days, it was called mental prayer. Today, I call my practice contemplative prayer, centering prayer. Now, the journey from mental prayer to contemplative prayer is what I will be sharing this morning. It is also a journey which has led to numerous changes in my sense of identity and a struggle to learn how to coexist in a world that identifies with one's achievements. My primary resources for this presentation and the theological and spiritual reflection of my own journey will come from an article by Beatrice Boutreau called Prayer and Identity, and from works by Cynthia Bourgeau and Martin Laird's book, A Sunlit Absence. I'll begin this chapter of my spiritual or soul journey back in the 1980s when I was living and working in Vermont. Now, in Vermont, there is a Buddhist temple, a quite famous Buddhist temple, called Karma Choling. I attended the Buddhist temple on numerous occasions to try and learn how our Buddhist brothers and sisters dealt with psychological issues. There were some great workshops being offered at the temple, and I would go often and sit in meditation with them. I was also doing a yoga practice at that time. And I attended Eucharist at the Western Priory and would go there almost daily for spiritual nourishment. So I was quite eclectic in my soul search. I lived in the country. Actually, almost all of Vermont is country. And I would often take walks on the back road for my exercise. One day as I was walking and reflecting on my spiritual search, I heard very clearly with the inner ears of my soul, "You can stop seeking. You already have your spiritual orientation. You are Catholic and you have Christian roots. Now go more deeply into your tradition. You will find there what you are searching for." That was immensely relieving for me. Instead of continuing to seek and search, I could now sit still and engage my prayer practice more deeply. At the same time, I made a decision to get a PhD in clinical psychology and chose to attend the Fielding Institute. I began my studies with a cluster group meeting in Cambridge, Massachusetts at that time. Now, a number of circumstances came together for me in the 1990, and Sister Francois, Lanaine, and I moved back to California and settled in Santa Barbara, California. We were offered a place to stay at the Notre Dame Convent in Santa Barbara. There, I settled into my office and worked diligently on my studies and writing a dissertation. Now, while all of this was happening in my external life, my spiritual life was in quite a different place. During this period of time, I felt such darkness in my prayer practice and was amazed that while one area of my life was flourishing, my studies, another area of my life seemed to be falling apart, or, as I now know, deepening. I moved back to California. When I moved back, we owned two properties in Vermont, one in which we had operated a center for personal growth, and the other, a home I dreamt would be my retirement home someday. It was a small, comfortable home which was built on the edge of the Green Mountain National Forest. We had the center sold and rented our home. But the week before the sale of the center was final, the buyers backed out. And then the real estate market hit a low. So I left Vermont with the center not sold. After about a year and a half of paying insurance on the home and property and running out of money, I decided I had to sell the home that I had hoped would be my retirement home. I knew that home would sell quickly, and it did. Following a sale of that home, which had little equity in it, the center property sold for much less than I had hoped for. In the meantime, the cost of the PhD was mounting, and I had to take out school loans. Now, right after the properties in Vermont sold, I was diagnosed with breast cancer and had to deal with all the emotions such a diagnosis brings on. I'm sure that some or all of you have gone through periods of your life when everything around you seems to collapse. What is the saying, when troubles come, they come in threes? I suppose all of the combination of these events helped plunge my soul into a place of deep darkness. I knew I was not depressed because I was functioning quite well in my studies, and I was beginning a private practice and providing therapeutic services. But in my soul, I knew only darkness. I also felt a sense of a loss of identity. Now, as part of my studies, I chose to attend a weekend of training with Jack Kornfield and Stanislav Grof of the Transpersonal Institute in holotropic breathwork. It was a very deep and intense week. During that week, we had intense meditation and real intense breath work. It became apparent to the workshop leaders that I was definitely in a dark night of the soul experience. I can not tell you how relieved I was to have my suspicions confirmed, but it did not alleviate the experience. What it did is provide a tiny light in the darkness. I learned how to navigate in the darkness and deal with the abundance of awarenesses that were emerging. Now, in mythic literature, this place of being is often called the underworld. It is a real place and a place where transformation occurs. It is a place of deep suffering and anguish, as it gives a mirror into our illusions of self. Here I became aware of all my pretenses my need to protect the sense of who I thought I was, and I felt stripped naked. I felt open and vulnerable and did not see how I could operate in the world with this type of vulnerability. But actually, after a period of time, I began to feel safe in that darkness. All during this time, I was seeing a Jungian analyst and analyzing my dreams, and was also in a group spiritual direction. And then it came time to come out. I felt a real push-pull experience. I had learned how to navigate in the dark, and coming back into the fullness of life felt overwhelming. But even more confusing was, who am I now? How do I define myself? I was certainly not the same person I had been before the dark night experience. My consciousness had changed. My worldview had changed. But I felt very young in my spirit. I could no longer identify with my descriptors. I remember when I was awarded my PhD in clinical psychology, I heard the chair of my dissertation committee proclaim, "We are about to confer on these students the highest degree in our land." I was amazed, as I felt I was just at the beginning of my studies, not the end. I was confused. Again, I asked myself, who am I really? A doctor of psychology? But that was just a title, a descriptor. It is not who I am. The only way I could answer that question authentically at this particular time was, I am a child of the divine, the creator of all beings. And I was okay with that. Except I couldn't go to professional meetings and other encounters and define myself in that way. I had to learn to navigate in a world where descriptors were so important. I remember at this particular period of time talking with colleagues who were also new PhD graduates. And they said to me, "Suzanne, have you ever tried using the title doctor when you make reservations at a restaurant or on an airplane?" I said, "No, why?" They said, "Try it." So I did. And indeed, there was a difference. I was treated differently. I was given a wonderful table. At the airlines, I was greeted with, "Hello, Dr. Dunn." But I was very uncomfortable. I never did it again. I knew it wasn't who I was. I knew it was a title I had. As the work of the Spirit would have it, I came upon the article by Beatrice Boutreau called Prayer and Identity. And I found solace and relief in my inability to identify with any place on the Enneagram or any other personality descriptive. In my dark night experience, I felt as if I had experienced every place on the Enneagram and could not settle on any one number. So when somebody says, "Are you a 2, a 4, a 6, or an 8? I say, "I don't know. I'm all." Martin Laird, in his book, A Sunlit Absence, states, "It should be kept in mind when we say I am an 8 on the Enneagram or an INFT on the Myers-Briggs that we are using the word am in an attributive sense, such as I am blonde." That is his words. I would have to say I am gray. Blonde is an attribute of a person's hair. "I am not blonde," Martin Laird says, "in the same way that I am Carolyn or Charles." The Enneagram and Myers-Briggs are attributes of our identity. To say I am a 6 or an 8 or a 9 and you're a 3 is like saying I am a shirt and you are a jacket. We have a shirt or a jacket that we may really like, but we are not a shirt or a jacket. We can never think they are the seat of identity or that they can definitively pin down personality. Yes, they are very helpful ways of charting the personality. And there was a period of time when I was very interested in them, and I still am. But there is always something essential about the human person that is unchartable, inscrutable, and hidden in mystery. In the Christian view of things, the essence of human identity is hidden in mystery, hidden with Christ in God, as stated in Colossians 3:3. I began to realize that any personality test only measures one facet of our identity, our personality. I had experienced so much more. I knew that my consciousness had been changed and my worldview had expanded. And now my task was to learn how to navigate in the Western world where descriptors are so important and dualism is a fait accompli. Beatrice Boutreau wrote, "The work of prayer is to transform our sense of identity." She uses a passage from the letter of James to explain this. Quote, "Humbly welcome the word which has been planted in you, because it has the power to save. But act on this word, because if all you do is listen to it, you are deceiving yourselves. Those who listen to God's words but don't put it into practice are like those who look into mirrors at their natural faces. They look at themselves and then promptly forget what they looked like. But those who look steadily at the perfect law of freedom and make it their habit will be blessed in all they do." End of the quote from James. Perhaps a good summary of this presentation could be summed up in the phrase, looking into a mirror, seeing your natural face, and then forgetting what you look like. But what is your natural face? What exactly do you see when you look into a mirror? What identity do you see? Take a minute now and turn to the person next to you and share with one another for a few minutes what you see when you look into a mirror. Begin to quiet down and come back. Finish a sentence if you're in the middle of the sentence. Judging by the sound that I heard up here, you do see things when you look into the mirror. In her article, Prayer and Identity, Beatrice Boutreau claims that as we deepen our prayer practice, our sense of identity does indeed change. In fact, she wrote, "The very work of prayer is to transform our sense of identity." Now, the transformation Boutreau has in mind is the final liberation of our sense of identity from a rigid, time-bound identity into an interior spaciousness that can travel at the speed of love. Just as I said that, I flashed upon a quote from Teilhard, which I don't think I can quote by heart, but some of you may know it. Once, after harnessing the winds of energy, and we will have discovered for the second time fire. I don't know why I thought of that. This process of transformation is the process of dying or transforming our differing identities. It is a process of moving from one sense of identity to another and deeper one until when we see what we see in the mirror is our natural face. But what is our natural face? Let's look at its opposite, a state of forgetfulness where we do not know who we really are at our core. Most of our great religious tradition and philosophies speak of this state of forgetfulness. We can go all the way back to Plato, who spoke of this mythically when he suggested that people choose their lives they will live before they are born, and then they drink the waters of the river of forgetfulness. Plunged into forgetfulness, they simply identify with the particular roles with which they are playing. It is the process of awakening, according to Plato, that brings them to truth, to reality called non-forgetfulness. The Hindus tell us that we are subject to non-seeing and that we mistake our selfhood, confusing it with our ego personality. They recommend the practice of yoga to bring us to realization of the absolute self. The problem of identity and forgetting who we truly are appears in all religious traditions as a fundamental spiritual problem. Prayer, or a prayer practice, is an important step in helping us clear our sense of identity. And this clarification can be experienced as analogous to awakening, remembering, or seeing correctly. In the course of a developing contemplative prayer life, we realize that we have been making certain assumptions about our identity that are not true, not deep enough, not dynamic enough, or otherwise too limited. Cynthia Bourgeau, in commenting on Beatrice Boutreau's work, states that how a person prays, that is, what kind of prayers she or he addresses to God, is an inescapable function of where that person is carrying his or her sense of identity. Prayer and identity are joined at the hip. As you conceive of your identity, so you will pray. And as those prayers rise like incense before God, they carry with them the unmistakable telltale signs of the sense of identity out of which they emerge. If we locate our sense of self in the experience of pleasure and pain, we are talking about our body and our emotions. In other words, our human personality. We believe that we are the ones who feel comfortable or uncomfortable, who is happy or unhappy. And how is this mirrored in our prayer life? First, we try to ameliorate the situation. We ask God to send us pleasant experiences and withdraw the painful ones. Take away my pain. Sometimes it seems as if our prayers are answered. But more often, the painful experiences continue. You know, we've all had the experience of people asking us to pray for them. Or we ourselves have turned to people and asked, please keep my sister in your prayer. She's going through a hard time. Please pray for this. Please pray for that. What are we asking for when we ask people to pray? Are we asking that the pain, the situation be removed, relieved? Or are we asking that God or the divine in some way accompany that person on the particular journey that they are going through at this time? If the situation continues, then our prayer life undertakes to transform them into pleasant experiences by finding meaning in them. We can see the painful experience as purifying, or we can see it as a penance, or as reparation, or as a necessary preparation for a positive experience yet to come. We can even move to the experience of sharing with St. Paul in the redemptive sufferings of Christ. In 1 Colossians 24, we read, even now, I find my joy in the suffering I endure for you. In my own body, I fill up what is lacking in the sufferings of Jesus for the sake of Christ's body, the church. I remember working with a person in spiritual direction who was being hit on all sides by some very serious situations in her life over which she had literally little or no control. I quoted this passage to her and asked her to take it home and pray about it. And later on, when I saw her and I could see by the look in her face that something had changed, some of the situations that she'd been dealing with had been ameliorated, had changed. But she said that the anchor that she held on to the most at that particular period of time was that perhaps she was sharing in the redemptive sufferings of Christ. And that got her through that particular difficult time. Because this perspective produces a deep level of satisfaction, even though the surface level of the human life remains painful. We are moving from our physical and emotional personality to the understanding and believing level of mind. I cannot change this circumstance, but maybe if I allow my sufferings to unite with Kai's sufferings, it will have more meaning for me. And yet another level of approach to prayer life locates our identity in the performer of moral acts. The moral agent self then relates to God in prayer in terms of God's approval or disapproval, in terms of pleasing or displeasing God, or in terms of seeking God's aid to do what is morally right. As this form of prayer life develops, one discovers many things about oneself. Some people report that they find in the depths of themselves the potentiality for all kinds of evil. I have to share with you that in that dark period of my prayer life, that was the most disconcerting, was the realization that not only goodness dwelled within me, but also the potentialities for evil. I found that I understood at a deeper level than ever before the phrase, there but for the grace of God go I. I realized in the depth of our beings that the potentialities are there, for good or for evil. In this level of prayer, the prayer life tends to be focused on analyzing or seeing into the deeper roots of our motives and seeking and asking divine aid to purify these motives. Have you ever started judging or thinking about or wondering about your sense of motivation? You are doing some good deed or you are embarking on some wonderful works, And then you're confronted within yourself, but what is this really about? Am I really doing this to help others, or am I doing this to feel good about myself? Or have you ever come to the place of having made some life decisions and having your life go a certain way, and then finding yourself judgmental? Well, I'm doing this. Why aren't other people doing this? So our motivation, we realize, is not always as pure as we thought. And it is quite disconcerting as we begin to see clearly aspects of ourselves that become judgmental of others. A fourth approach in our prayer life reflects on all the foregoing and draws a metaphysical conclusion. I am nothing. God is everything. I can do nothing of myself but sin. The source of all being and all goodness is God alone. Whatever share in being or goodness I have it only as God's gift for me. In some of our spiritual writings of our early desert mothers and fathers, but I'm thinking beyond that. I don't see it so much in there. I'm thinking of Alphonsus Liguori, Tanqueray, the author of the, what was that book, I Am a Worm, Not a Man, Not a Woman. But who is it? Imitation of Christ. The Imitation of Christ. I Am a Worm, Not a Man. It comes from this place of seeing that all goodness resides in God. And from that place, all I can do is receive. I can only receive what it is that God wishes to give to me. It's at this point when we realize in our beings that praise and criticism are the same thing. You can hear somebody giving you praise, and you can accept it knowing full well that that is not all of who you are. Likewise, you can hear criticism about yourself, and you can also accept that, knowing full well that that isn't all there is to you. But Beatrice Boutreau says this is not the end of our growing in our prayer lives. All of these modes of prayer discussed so far assume without question that the identity of the one who prays is in the finite order. What does this imply? Well, to be finite means to be a determinant being, someone with particular qualities or predicates. In other words, someone who is capable of being described to be this rather than that. Logicians will tell us that all of determination is by negation. Cynthia Bourgeau claims that here, Boutreau is naming the primary filter through which we post-Cartesian Westerners look upon ourselves in the world. It sets in early, and it cuts deep. Cynthia says she can hear her 3-year-old granddaughter singing along with Sesame Street jingle, "One of these things is not like the other," and realizes that as this child learns how a cat is not a dog, she is also absorbing the basic methodology of mental egoic consciousness, perception through differentiation. This process begins very early in our childhood training, and soon we learn what it is that makes us different from everyone else. You know that saying that no one is made just like you. You have your own particular uniqueness. Did we ever hear growing up that we are one with the plants, the animals, other children, all sentient beings? So if our location of identity begins as seeing ourselves as different from everyone, competition and conflict with others naturally occurs as we are seeing to defend our uniqueness against all other competing uniquenesses. Welcome to the fall. Boutroux ironically points out that it is this initial mistake of identifying our selfhood with our finite descriptors that give rise to those experiences of pain, alienation, and guilt which fuel the usual modalities of our prayer life. These are the artificial faces, created not so much by sin as a basic perceptual tool we use to navigate reality. Our mental egoic operating systems have been programmed to differentiation as a fundamental interpretive mode, and we are unable to perceive or sustain unitive oneness. Now, Boutroux's insights have been foundational to my own personal experience of centering prayer. Through my own dark night experiences and journeying with this prayer form, I have discovered that a contemplative prayer practice does rewire a person from mental egoic perception into something more spacious, something Cynthia Bourgeau calls heart perception. But the heart of Boutroux's essay is crucial to me. She makes the point that our sense of identity is fluid. It does not always come from the same place inwardly. And I'm sure as we navigate our everyday world, we are very deeply aware of that. This was true even for Jesus. His, quote, "Why do you call me good? No one is good except the Father," end of quote, does not come from the same place as, quote, "I and the Father are one," end of quote. The former reveals a more constricted sense of selfhood than the latter, which is totally unbounded. In the same way, our own locus of identity is constantly fluctuating back and forth along a continuum from constricted to unbounded and back again. I am sure that most, if not all of you, have experienced an unbounded energy emerging from your prayer practice. In this place, our sense of self transcends all descriptions by coming to a sense of denying its identification with our limited self. Boutroux says, "I take this to be the metaphysical, mystical meaning of self-denial." Now, in centering prayer, the basic journey is one of letting go. Letting go of thoughts and feelings and surrendering over and over and over again to the unbounded, undivided fullness. Over a period of time, maybe years, one becomes more and more adept at resting in the divine and experiencing transforming union. Boutroux claims when you are perfectly empty of all predicates, including the description of yourself as a receiver, then you are intensely full of pure I am. And just as this point is reached, it explodes into the creative outpouring energy. She calls this spondic energy. Spondic, S-P-O-N-D-I-C. It's a word she uses and has made up. And describes it as the love that moves the sun and the stars and pours out as the life blood of the communion of saints and joyously reckless self-giving to the gospel path. Other people have defined it differently. Other people have shared with me that they feel it's like a whoosh that just comes over them. Others feel as if it's a sense of having lost for the moment, and it usually is but a moment's insight or a moment's grasp, their whole sense of who they are or their whole sense of being and feeling that feeling of oneness. I suspect most of you have felt that at some point or other in your life, in your prayer life, in your walking in the woods, in your marveling at a sunset. It is that complete letting go of self for a moment or so and being totally at one with. But she goes a little further and says that that feeling brings on a sense of energy, which she calls spandic energy. Is this what Paul Smith is referring to when he admonishes us to own our own divinity? On page 217, he wrote, "The traditional church believes in original sin. The postmodern church believes in original goodness. The integral church believes in original divinity." And in his chapter on religion and the escalator, he states at the end of that chapter, "Just emerging now is the mystical religion of the integral and beyond stages. Integral and beyond has transcended magic and myth to reach the meaning of the mental stage. The mystical allows us to connect with spiritual realities and ultimately to the divine reality, that we are all a part of God and one another." Now, I do not have any personal difficulty with owning that I am a part of God and of all the sentient beings. I have experienced times in my prayer practice when I am free of all descriptors and experience the pure I am. Is that owning my divinity? I don't know. Paul Smith quotes St. Basil the Great speaking of the highest of all desires, becoming God. "Having been conditioned to seeing my uniqueness in opposition to your uniqueness, and grown up in a competitive society struggling to maintain that sense of uniqueness, it is quite a change in consciousness to perceive myself and live from a place that sees one's very self as divine and connecting to each of you as divine. And yet that is what we say when we say namaste, isn't it? The divine in me greets the divine in you." I mentioned earlier that as I was coming out of my dark night of the soul experience, I defined myself as a child of the divine. But children grow up, don't they? I wish I could have remained a child. Over the course of time, that identity no longer fit me. Recently, as I looked at myself in the mirror once again and asked, "Who do you see? Who do I see?" I heard from that heart place the answer, I am with the one who is. I am comfortable with that identification at this present moment. Will it continue to evolve? I hope so. Will I one day feel comfortable in saying, "I am God"? I don't know. Right now, I am not. Right now, I am comfortable with saying, "I am with the one who is." But as we are all evolving, as we are all growing, as we all continue our readings and our discussions, who knows how my sense of identity will continue to evolve. I remain open and hope to discover what the next stage of the journey is. I think we'll pause for the break, and then afterwards I'll be available for comments, reflections, or questions.